And the court will proceed to the fourth case, the NLRB versus the International Brotherhood of Electrical Engineers, I guess. Let's see. Electrical workers. Mr. Berger.
May it please the members of the court. The NLRB, in presenting their brief, said there was only one issue, and we say very clearly not only are they wrong, but they gave the wrong issue. The issue before this court of a fundamental basis is whether or not the jurisdiction of the court was completed by the NLRB in seeking this enforcement action. Appellate Rule 17A required the board to have filed a transcript.
I'm interested. We'll talk about the actual jurisdictional question later. I'm interested in why the electrical workers think it would be a good idea for us to establish a rule that if the board fails to file the record in 40 days, the case must be dismissed. Usually the union is aligned with the board. Often agencies don't file the record in time. And on your view, all the cases that the union won before the board would go down the drain whenever the board was careless about filing the record. So is this the position that the electrical workers want us to adopt?
This is the position the electrical workers believe the court should adopt for several reasons, Your Honor. One is that most parties in coming to the court are bound by specific time rules, and we're not given the basis to seek deference. What we have here is a total disregard of the court and its rules, because my experience is that if you're late...
You're not answering my question how this serves the long-term interests of your client.
Well, I think it serves the long-term...
My response to this is that you're shooting yourself in the foot. If you persuade us to adopt this rule, your client will be the biggest loser, and America's employers will be delighted because it means that they'll be able to get out from under all these nasty board orders when the board, as it frequently does, fails to file a record on time. And America's unions will probably send out a large number of well-armed people looking for you. I just wonder why this is the argument you're making.
Well, I'm not worried about who they send out looking for me, Your Honor, because there are a lot of people that don't like me over the years. But I believe that the rules apply to everyone, and I wasn't looking at the big picture as you were. I would concede that much. But we came here because of a very important principle. And if in holding that principle, it means that the board loses because they didn't follow your rules, then so be it. We'll be bound by that. I don't think that unions today necessarily even look to the board for relief anymore. But I think that a rule is a rule. I'm required to follow them.
Can I quote you the next time an employer seeks to set a board decision aside? You know, according to the electrical workers, the board's decisions don't matter, so, who cares?
I think you could say that Charlie Berger said that, and that I met that, and my client, Local 16, would say that.
All right, now let's talk about the jurisdictional question.
Could
in Rule 17 says it's a rule of subject matter jurisdiction or appellate jurisdiction?
But
it's just a time limit.
It says that it must be filed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't filed. They didn't even see.
But what makes it a rule of jurisdiction?
Because if you don't have the
training. The world is full of time limits that are non-jurisdictional. Let me give you a good example. The statute of limitations. It's a time limit. It's not jurisdictional. It has nothing to do with subject matter jurisdiction.
But you lose if you don't meet it. Would you agree? I mean, Your Honor, that if you don't meet.
You may or may not lose if you raise your affirmative defense in time. But it's not a question of subject matter.
But if you're bringing the action, you lose if you don't do it timely. As a plaintiff's lawyer, I lose if I don't file it within 2 years.
Do you know, counsel, the difference between rules of subject matter jurisdiction and other time limits?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you articulate it for me?
Subject matter jurisdiction would be that the subject that's before this court is something that is not within your purview, either under the Constitution or under a statute that we brought it under. The time limit would be is that we didn't file the lawsuit in a timely manner. And in this particular case, their failure to comply with the enforcement requirements prevents them, we believe, in presenting the court with the evidence to come after to come suppose, forward in their case.
Suppose you fail. Rules of appellate procedure gave you a certain number of days to file a brief. Suppose you filed your brief one day late. Would we be required to dismiss the appeal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction?
No, but I would be required to file a motion for leave of the court to file it late, which they didn't even do in this case.
Look, that is unrelated to jurisdiction. What, in your view, distinguishes the rule for the timely filing of briefs, which you say is non-jurisdictional, from the rule for the timely filing of records, which you say is jurisdictional?
The transcript not being with the... Well, I can't, Your Honor.
And, in fact, there's nothing whatsoever in the rule that distinguishes those two situations.
But Your Honor, we believe that the rule is a rule that should be followed, or you wouldn't have...
That's why I asked you whether you understood what subject matter jurisdiction is. There is a big difference between mandatory deadlines and subject matter jurisdiction. In fact, twice last year, the Supreme Court discussed it at length in cases called Scarborough against Principe and Contrick against Ryan. It's quite obvious from your brief that you're unaware of those cases.
That's correct.
It seems to me you're unaware of the distinction between the rules.
I'm not unaware of the distinction between the rules, Your Honor. What I'm saying is the court has the rule. The NLRB made no showing as to why they should be excused from the rule.
This is why I've asked whether you know what a jurisdictional rule is. A rule can be mandatory without being jurisdictional. When they fail to file a record, you might have, if you wanted, filed a motion to dismiss for want of prosecution. That's the same kind of thing that could be filed by them if you didn't file your brief on time. But it wouldn't be jurisdictional. A jurisdictional rule is something that limits the power of the court to decide. There's no doubt the court has the power to excuse noncompliance, to accept briefs in standard. The only rule of jurisdiction, the Supreme Court has said, is the need to file a timely notice of appeal, or in the case of petitions for review of administrative agencies, a timely petition for review. Everything else after that, the Supreme Court has said more times than I can count, is a rule of practice. Failure to comply with a rule of practice may lead to dismissal for failure to comply, but not in a jurisdictional sense, and certainly not the biggest subject matter jurisdiction requirement of all, is the court has to enforce it even if the parties want to excuse it.
I agree, Your Honor. And well, we may have misnamed our motion to dismiss, and I apologize to the court for that.
Couldn't we simply issue an order today extending the deadline for filing the record to August 6, 2004?
Yes, you could, but they never asked for that relief. They ignored.
But then it's not jurisdictional. As soon as you say that, you concede that it's not jurisdictional.
I think I did earlier, Your Honor. I'll sit down because I'm into my rebuttal time.
But before you do...
won't be anything to rebut.
Before you do, could you just tell me what's meant by the term legal referral facilities in the sentence in the Toyota agreement that says the execution contractors agree to recognize and be bound by the legal referral facilities maintained by the union?
The union hall has a hiring hall, and we believe that what the legal referral, that term I didn't write, I don't know, but I assume it means that they follow the law, which we believe the NLRB found that they did by showing that the $64 that was owed was not a violation when they demanded it from Mr. Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Ms. Burdick.
Good morning. Ruth Burdick appearing for the National Labor Relations Board.
Why didn't you embrace their jurisdictional argument? Then the lawyers for the NLRB would be able to take long vacations to Disney.
In certain cases,
be
it
no
would
cases
be.
Anymore.
In certain cases, it would be rather handy on a practical level, but frankly, there's just no basis for the interpretation of Rule 17 that that the union presents to this court. And I'd just like to point out something that I don't think I'll disadvantage the other side from, because it's an advisory committee note that attaches to Rule 17. This specifically notes that the 67 adoption of the 40-day period, with regard to that, it says, quote, 40 days are allowed in order to avoid useless preparation of the record or certified listing cases where the application for enforcement is not contested. In other words, under Rule 15, the party against whom the board is seeking enforcement must answer within 20 days, and Rule 15 provides if they do not, default can be taken and a default judgment entered against them enforcing the board's order. That is, and then the board, that what this does is allows the party to answer. The court then looks to verify that the answer is sufficient, and then the 40-day mark is when the board will typically file the certified record. And it's therefore an administrative it's an administrative rule for agency efficiency, saves resources. This is not a jurisdictional issue. And as we all know, the circuit courts that I deal with very often operate and exercise that discretion they have under Rule 17 to vary the time deadlines for the certified record. Here, I'm sorry to say that I have nothing but representations of our litigation services department that prepares the record that they contacted the court, and there was discussions, and you have that material in the brief. I won't repeat it now. But that does illustrate the typical ways that our agency litigation services will deal with the court on a certified list. And here we have a situation where there was a court clerk who was operating fully consistently with that purpose I read of the advisory committee under Rule 17 by simply saying, well, we're waiting to make to take a look at the answer to make sure it was sufficient. We'll let you know when the record's going to be due. What the only thing the agency did wrong here is we should have followed that up by letter, email, etc., and verified that the court wished us to hold the record until they had taken a look at the answer. This is simply an administrative rule.
Are you now saying that it's the board's practice not to file the record on time?
No, it's the board's practice.
Unless somebody from the court calls and says we want it?
No, Your Honor, I didn't mean to represent that. The board's practice is to comply with Rule 17 and file it within 40 days unless we hear otherwise. And this is a situation where there was conversations back and forth, and we were told by the clerk to wait, and an order will issue specifying which date to file the record. And that is a situation that does occur in many circuits, where the circuit court will set a date other than 40 days. And this is a matter that fell through the cracks. We would typically file within 40 days.
Should you?
But that does not mean that the case should be dismissed, and that's in nobody's interest, because we could simply refile. There's no time limit for enforcement proceedings. All that would do is waste this court's time and the agency resources. If they dismissed on that basis, I could walk into the clerk's office and file another application for enforcement and be back here in 4 months or 9 months. It would just do nothing but delay the proceeding.
Should you have submitted an affidavit or other evidence regarding inquiry made to the clerk's office? Do you do that normally?
This is a very atypical situation. We weren't asked by the court to do so, and we would have done so if necessary. this is an extremely unusual situation. The board's practice is to obviously comply with Rule 17. And here we thought we diligently had. I can't speak.
We don't have non-record that many here. Labor Board cases compared to the cases from some other agencies. But there
yes,
are
Your Honor.
At least two federal agencies that probably have not complied with Rule 17 within the memory of anyone in this room.
Could I just ask you the same
yes.
question that I asked Mr. Berger? Because I have been trying to figure out what that term means.
I understand, Your Honor.
What the term legal referral facilities.
On the facts of this case, and this is a stipulated record, my best understanding, because we don't have any insight into the intent of the parties who entered that agreement, is simply on the stipulated facts here. I think, in my opinion, it basically means nothing more than the fact that the parties agreed to be bound by the hiring hall referral system, which is simply a mechanism where the union checks qualifications and places people according to the contract that is applicable into a position. And here, the Toyota agreement had no union security clause. That was the applicable contract for which employee Collins was being referred to the Toyota job. And that was the contract provisions and the referrals provisions that are specifically in the Toyota contract should have been implemented by the hiring hall, the referral system.
But so doesn't that mean adopting the NECA agreement's contractual provisions?
No, it does not, Your Honor. It's very clear that the Toyota agreement, the parties entered the Toyota agreement, could have, and were fully capable of negotiating union security clause, did not do so. The Toyota agreement it contains specific referral procedures that vary from the NECA agreement. The Toyota agreement states that it was a complete agreement of the party and it was to override any other local, area, or national agreement, such as the NECA agreement. The union here argues that they did before the board and they do before this court, argue that on the sole basis that the union security clause in NECA was incorporated by reference in Toyota. This is an absurd argument of just basic contract principles. There is no reference to NECA. The Toyota agreement has a merger clause that says it's a complete agreement. It has a provision that says this is overriding any other agreement, such as the NECA agreement, and actually has referral procedures that vary from that of the NECA agreement without any mention of NECA. In other words, without a union security clause, an employee coming to the union referral hall could apply for a job at the Toyota construction site without being a union member, and therefore also without being a union member in good standing. There was no membership maintenance of membership requirement under the Toyota agreement, and for this union to have insisted that employee Collins pay his dues and be a member in good standing, it was a violation of Section 8B1A, because it was coercively insisting upon a membership or fee provision of membership that did not exist for application to the Toyota job. If employee Collins had come in and applied for a position that the NECA contract covered, then the NECA provisions would apply, and he would have had to have paid his dues. There's no legal dispute here among the parties that if there is no union security clause, it's unlawful for a union operating a referral hall such as this to refuse to place an employee on the basis of delinquent dues. That there's no actual legal dispute here. This is only a factual dispute in the sense that the union argues that the union security clause of NECA contract was incorporated by reference into Toyota agreement. There's no basis for that such an argument. And I haven't seen such a simple contract case in a long time, and I hope it's as clear to the court as it is to me. Although that phrase that you refer to, nobody knows exactly the meaning.
Yeah.
But what we can do is we can look at the stipulated facts. And in the stipulated facts, on page 2 of the decision and order, makes clear that the Toyota agreement, I don't have the specific language here. Excuse me. The Toyota agreement was to operate, all the hiring of electricians for the Toyota agreement jobs were to come through the hiring hall. That's a separate matter from the fact that a hiring hall must apply the appropriate contract, the pertinent contract, to which job an employee is being referred. And here the union simply had not. I can imagine an administrator might be confused, administrator of the hiring hall, because there had been no other contract, but that's no excuse. This is a situation where it's a clear illustration of why the board has always interpreted the act to find these sorts of violations, because if a union hiring hall, the union is in a very strong position to, my time is up. To potentially coerce and encourage membership, and the adherence to membership requirements, such as the no delinquent dues in order to be referred. And here we have a clear violation.
Thank you, Ms. Burdick. Ms. Burdick, just a footnote to your earlier discussion with my colleagues. I believe even accepting the NLRB's position as to the timeline, I think the contact with our clerk's office was more than 40 days. The initial contact was more than 40 days. So just as whatever the court decides, it decides. But I think it's clear from us all
we could have, our litigation services could have handled the deadline better. On the other hand, there's absolutely no authority for the interpretation of Rule 17.
I don't want to get into that. I just wanted to suggest that if running close to the line on the 40 days, administratively, you might want to reflect upon making the phone call
in advance
of the 40 days.
And we typically would, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Berger.
Thank you.
Berger.
I want to respond to the comment by counsel that I think points to the fallacy of the board's decision. It says that they were all bound by the union agreement in the hiring hall. The union controls the hiring, controls the way they operate the hiring hall. The board didn't find that the operation of the hiring hall was unlawful. They said that they violated the Toyota agreement. The board found that the union didn't violate the NLRA by requiring the dues of Mr. Collins, because for what they are attempting to protect, these aren't the facts. Mr. Collins was a 30-year member of the union. He was a former business manager. He had enforced these same rules. The board's opinion has this conflict internally within it, and we believe that the union didn't do anything wrong and that Mr. Collins was not entitled to that referral. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed to